This is Metal Mike, and in this episode, the script gets flipped. My buddy Ryan asked me the questions, and the questions are about my new book, A Hair Metal Journey. Yes, it's all about the stories from the bands that I've talked to over the years, plus my own personal stories of being a little metal maniac in the 80s. If you've been enjoying the podcast over the past 4 years, and you want to give us some love, you want to give us some support, go on Amazon, buy the paperback, get it on Kindle, whatever way you like to read books, man. But now it's time to check this out.
All right. Well, Mike, welcome to your 80s glam metal cast, dude. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. This is crazy because I feel like we've done all these podcasts and now it's like the roles have been reversed. So this is, it's scary. You know what I mean? I have no idea what you're going to ask me. We didn't plan any of this, so I don't know what the questions are. So now the roles have been completely reversed, obviously. So this should be fun.
Yeah, man. This would be great. Well, today we're here to discuss your brand new book, A Hair Metal Journey, which focuses on the years 1986 to 1991. Did you ever think that someone would be interviewing you on your show about the book that you wrote?
No. I mean, you know, the funniest thing was, is like, I want to say like maybe a couple years ago, what popped in my head, like, oh, maybe I could write a book someday with all of these interviews and all this stuff. And then I was like, nah, I don't think so. And then I never thought about it again. Then I had this, I was on vacation and I couldn't sleep. And it was just like, I mean, it was going on for hours. You know, sometimes you're in like a foreign place and you just can't sleep. And it just started, the book, it was like an audio book, just started running in my head. You know, it was like 1980, your first memory of getting these records when you were a little kid. You know, like all this stuff just started playing in my head. And then in the morning, I didn't want to like, you know, I'm still trying to fall asleep, so I'm not trying to grab like or something to write.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to write this all out. You know, I don't want to disrupt my wife and everything while she's trying to sleep. So, so you know, finally I did fall asleep, but then I woke up that next day and I just started hammering out, and it was just a constant flow. And here we are, got it done.
Well, yeah, that's great. And just I might add before we really get going, congratulations on it being number one in the heavy metal biographies on Amazon.
That's crazy. You know, I was just looking at it. So I guess it's number one in new releases. I think it's like number five overall in heavy metal books. And it's doing pretty good, man. I mean, thanks to everybody. The support is great and much appreciated. And just, yeah, it's very cool. Very cool.
Well, awesome, dude. Well, the book takes you on a journey through the years, specifically detailing a band or their record release at the time. What I enjoyed and found so different than most books was kind of walking through not only your personal experience with that band or album, but then it followed up with an excerpt from the band member themselves. Tell me about the concept and how it was speaking to your childhood heroes.
Well, let's just say there was no real concept at first. Okay, so I think going into it, I was just like, I started thinking of, okay, so the first step was maybe I could tell my story, right? At least a part of it as it pertains to music. And as the book starts off, I'm kind of realizing, well, I don't know if there's that many people are interested in my story. I'm not a famous musician or anything like that. So, okay, that part of it's not going to work on its own. Then the light bulb kind of went off and was like, hey, dipshit, you interviewed, you know, 100 people or I don't know how many people I've interviewed, but it's a lot. And asking around, you know, I kind of find out that I own the rights to those interviews. Those are interviews that I did. It's no different if, you know, somebody from Tiger Tales did an interview with Kerrang. You know, Kerrang pretty much has the right to that interview. So that's kind of, that was the beginning part of it. Was like, okay, I could tell a little bit of my story. And I think, Ryan, the reason why I want to tell my story, it's not because I think it's some interesting story or it's a great story. I just want people to relate because I think they can relate. You know what I mean? I feel like they, you know, people my age, older and a little bit younger, they remember going to record stores. They remember the T-shirts they had. They remembered the concerts, the first concerts they went to. I'm just trying to put that out there and maybe you could insert your own life and your own stories into what I said. So I think that's really what I'm trying to do. I'm getting nostalgic. Hopefully you'll get nostalgic. And then, hey, for bonus, like some whipped cream and sprinkles, we got the actual guys that made the music that I love and you guys all probably love. So that was the concept, pretty simple. The only thing that happened is as I got going is when you put this in order, when you frame it but year by year, you start finding similar stories from everybody. Like everybody's saying,
right.
Oh, I got the ballad got pushed on me, or oh, we had the album done, but we had to rewrite it. And it's like it's constant, you know? And then the light bulb goes off, and it's like, wait a minute, maybe we can explore who destroyed this genre, what destroyed this genre. So I think there's some times where it's really lighthearted and fun. And then there's other times where we dissect it and we get a little bit deep. But like I said, it's not a super long book. It's, you know, it's like large print, 200 pages with pictures. So you can bang this out pretty quick. It's not overly expensive either. So it's not like I'm, you know, giving you like a fairly short book and charging you an arm and a leg for it. It's a relatively cheap book. Next part. Okay, so I'll move on to oh my God, you know, getting talking to all my heroes. It's like, and I think, how do I say this? All right, so here's what happens. Anybody who does something like this, you don't necessarily take a lot of time to realize what you've been doing. You know what I mean? So, like, right. You know the deal. Like, especially in the beginning, I was putting on, like, two a week sometimes, or one a week. Or
yeah.
So, as soon as you're interviewing Mark Kendall from Great White, you know, later that week you're interviewing Chip Zdunoff or Steve Bliss. And I don't know if I ever took a lot of time. Like, I thought it was cool at the time. You know, I was like, oh, this is great, you know. But then you're constantly in this flow. You put on another episode, transcribing it, blah, 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 going through it. And I think writing the book kind of helped me step back, and it's like, holy shit. I remember sitting in my room, and I think I mentioned this, you know, studying the album covers and studying the liner notes. And it's like,
oh, yeah.
Almost like I came full circle. Like, I didn't, like, disregard all this stuff and go in some other direction. I hung on to it. And I brought my hobby out, like, to the forefront. Like, I got to talk to all these guys. And it is cool. You know what I mean? Yeah, okay, it happened, you know, over 30 years later. So, you know, it would have been cooler if it happened in 1987. But it is still very cool. So many of the people I talked to were decent. I still communicate with them now. A lot of people that I interviewed have been sharing the story about the book. So, no, it's super cool. It is like dream come true kind of stuff. And I feel like this is kind of like a way to just, I call this, it's like the 80s glam metal cast souvenir book or tour book. You know what I mean? We don't go super deep necessarily with any one band. It's kind of impossible. I can't write a whole book about Lillian Axe, even though I would like to. You know, I just kind of give you little blips of information that I thought was cool when I did the interview. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so, yeah, definitely, you know, it was an honor to talk to these people.
Well, that's good. And I totally can relate to all these cool stories you tell about, you know, record stores and liner notes and all that stuff. And I really thought your concept of adding the excerpts in there from the actual artist was a really cool new idea. So I thought it was great. And it's a really easy read. And
yeah,
for a bunch of metalheads like us, you know, it better be.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm sure there's, like, grammar problems in it. I'm sure, you know. But I always look at it like, this is rock and roll, man. You know what I mean? And I feel like, even to critique myself, there's sometimes, you got to look at it too. I'm almost going back to, like, my juvenile days. So it probably sounds somewhat juvenile, you know, the stuff that I did and the stuff that I say. Because, you know, I get it. There's some guys that were, like, 20 during this era. They were probably really partying and having a good time. I was just like 10 years old when I got into this stuff. So
yeah.
I was really like a friggin' child. So some of it may come across as childlike, but then I feel like there's other times where I got a little bit more deep and maybe that was more descriptive and more interesting. So I think there's a clash of different ideas in there where there's some juvenile stuff that's just me talking. I feel like with any book that I've ever enjoyed, I never really gave a shit if they were like eloquent. You know what I mean? I just wanted to hear that person tell me their story or a story, you know what I mean? And that's all this is, you know what I mean? I'm not trying to impress anybody. I couldn't impress you if I tried when it comes to, you know, being a writer. I'm not a writer. I'm not an author. I'm not a journalist. I'm none of that stuff. I feel like I'm just a fan that got to talk to the people that I listen to. That's pretty much all I am.
Well, you already impressed me with busting out the word eloquent in the interview.
See?
So good job.
I was looking up different words last night, big words I could use.
Oh, perfect. All right. Well, here's one that might make you think a little bit. So this is not going to be the juvenile metal mic. This is going to be now. And I'm going to ask you this.
Okay.
What is it about metal in general that appeals to you so much? Have you ever broken that down and really thought of it?
You know, honestly, I think one thing I tried to do with the book And I guess to answer it right off the bat, I don't really know. You know what I mean? I don't know. You know, why do we like anything? Why do I like pizza? It tastes good. Why do I like metal? It sounds good. I don't know. You know what I mean? But I feel like what I tried to do, and I wasn't doing this for the reader. I was just kind of doing this for myself. The very beginning, I blow through like a couple of years where I'm just a little kid and I'm not even listening to metal. And I don't get too deep into myself because I get it. Nobody really cares. But the only reason why I wanted to frame some of like who I was, because I think who I was explains how I got to where I am. You know what I mean? So I feel like if I was big into like it, coming up in the 80s, like being a kid, you're coming up with like WWF, right?
Well, we'll find out in just a moment.
Right? You got these giant characters, their long hair, and they're very commanding, and they wear makeup and flashy costumes, you know? Like, this is just the norm, you know what I mean? Or Rambo, or frigging Batman, or Star Wars, whatever it is. Like, there's all this over-the-top, larger-than-life characters. So I think that's where this comes from, at least the beginning of it, you know? And then when you say, like, there's a part in the book where I say, well, I had to collect all the wrestling figures. I did the same damn thing with cassettes. You know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah,
this is what I'm about. And I know other people can relate to it. It's like, we're nerds. We're collectors. We're, you know, we like flashy, in-your-face stuff. It's just what we grew up around. So it continues to make sense. I think with anybody who likes metal and glam metal and hard rock and everything, you just like stuff with an edge. Even if it looks glammy,
yes.
Like, there's something about that just registers with you. You know, there was kids that it didn't register with them. You know, there was kids that like rap or country, and that's cool. There's something about them that so they identify with that. But it's like that's why I tried to kind of frame like, okay, this was some of the stuff that I was doing prior, so it makes sense. You know, I like the Rambo movies, so I'm gonna like Kane Roberts. You know what I mean? So like, this is all in my wheelhouse. So I think that's where it came from. But I think it's just what people like. We like something with an edge, you know, and I think that's, at the end of the day, that's what that sounds right to us. And it still sounds great to me today, so.
I like that. I could totally relate to the characters thing. That's why people still reference the big Arnolds and Rambos and whatnot of that genre, because they still kind of defined these massive characters. I totally agree.
Yeah, that's what we grew up with. You know what I mean? Like, I think of like He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
And the Masters of the Universe.
Okay, now you give me Manowar. It's all one and the same. You know what I mean? So we were raised on this stuff. So the next logical thing, if music was going to be your thing and you're getting into your early teens, if that's what you were coming from before, why the hell wouldn't you like this? A lot of them would sing about it. Look at like Dio and Yngwie. They're always slaying dragons and shit. You know what I mean? It's just all up. It's all up my alley. So
damn, did we just uncover a massive conspiracy?
we've been marketed to our whole lives, and it was just brainwashing.
All right. Okay. So obviously, Kiss to you and AC/DC for me are clearly our number one bands forever and always.
Yep.
And
yep.
Recently I had an epiphany that at this point their music is so listened to and celebrated in our households that it's almost like an additional family member at this point. You know what I mean?
It is.
So tell me about the impact that Kiss had on you.
I mean, I feel like I'm just... You don't even need, anyone who listens to this doesn't need to buy the book. I'm going to tell you everything that's in the book right here.
Yeah.
I'm going to hold back something. You know, there's something really good in there that I'm not going to discuss. But no, Kiss, you know, I think with Kiss, and I get into this a little bit in the book. At first, Kiss was just like any other band in the 80s. They look just like Motley Crue, and they tried to. Actually, they didn't look as good as Motley Crue. They tried. It was just like, you know, they were just like everybody else. But that was the gateway. Like, that's what got me in. But once I went back, and they had so many different kinds of styles that they dabbled in, whether it be disco or metal or experimental or whatever, you know, classic 70s rock. There was a lot of different sounds that they were kind of throwing out there. So that made it interesting.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, this is the biggest example of superheroes that are rock stars. You know what I mean? They've got the makeup. Yeah. And, you know, you could also look at it when you look at, like, characters when it comes to, like, action figures back in the day. You know, there was this kind of He-Man, and then there was this with the battle armor, whatever. You know, they always had these variations. Kiss was a perfect example of that. Kiss had so many different variations. These are the, you know, the 1974 costumes. These are the Dynasty costumes. You know, I mean, there's so much fandom. So, like, if you're a fandom person and you just get sucked into this kind of stuff and a completist and all this kind of stuff, Kiss is just everything. I mean, it's just, it is what it is. You know, you're just hooked on it. I'll never not be hooked on it. I'll always be interested in what they're doing. I don't necessarily always agree with everything they do, but I'm always on top of it, following it. And you made a great example when you said they're like a family member. I think when, like, Paul or Gene dies, I think it's going to have, like, catastrophic effects on me. It really will, because that's so much like that I was connected to for, geez, I don't know, you know, 40 years almost at this point. You know what I mean? So it's going to be weird when they're not around anymore. Like, and I'm talking about on this planet. I think if they quit, I think I'll survive. I think if they pass away, I'll survive. But I don't mean it that way. But I just think that you really made a good point. Like, it is part of my life. It's something that my kids have gotten into a little bit because of me. We took them to Kiss concerts. We painted them up. So there's so much stuff. And it's like, Kiss was with me through all these different eras, through my early days and the hair metal era of the 80s. Then when they did the reunion with their makeup, still going to this day. And it's, like I said, me and my youngest son, he plays guitar. We play Kiss songs constantly when we jam together. So, you know, you really nailed it. Like, Kiss is a big part of the framework of this family. My wife and I, we went to a lot of Kiss conventions when we first got together. So, yeah, a Kiss family for sure.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, I know you could literally write a book on Kiss.
I totally could.
As big of a fan as you are, so that was a good Reader's Digest version of that one. I know we could talk forever about that.
I could talk forever.
But yeah, no, that's cool.
Pun intended, forever, you know?
Yeah. You know, you walk down our hallways and there's Uncle John, there's Grandpa Joe, there's Uncle Angus, there's Uncle Ace. They're all family members now.
Totally, man. Yup, totally.
So, all right, so let's move on to Motley, okay? So. Okay. Motley Theater of Pain, that was quite an introductory album for you as a young man at that point, because, you know, like I said, this focuses on your start in 86. The album came out just a year prior.
Yep.
So tell me about the importance of Motley Crue solidifying your love of the genre.
It was just like, it's really where it all started, I think, for me. Because, like, I could never really pinpoint what I bought first. But, like, to me, like, I feel like that was the beginning. You know what I mean? And it was, like, and that was the biggest band doing it. Like, they were the first ones to really come out with that glam, feminine glam, you know, lace and polka dots and feminine makeup, at least for my eyes. I know what happened with the New York Dolls and different things in the 70s. But we're talking about, for me, you know, I'm looking at these dudes, and, you know, in theory, you'd be thinking to yourself, back then, you'd think, well, what's wrong with these guys? Why are they dressing like girls? But in my mind, I'm like, this makes total sense, and these guys look cool, and these guys were, like, my heroes. So that was just that first band that I got really connected to. They were my first favorite band. Granted, they did get knocked out by Kiss down the road, but that was my first band, and I went right down the road, right, of the fandom, because at that point, there was posters that you could get, and there was T-shirts and pins and, you know, you name it. I had to have everything that had Motley Crue on it. And once again, it was just that edge. They had that edge. They were dangerous. Even when they were dressed up in their pink lace, they still had a dangerous... They had tattoos still. You could tell they were still badasses, you know? And of course, I mean, I went back. I got Shout at the Devil. Like, actually, I talk about my cousins gave me Shout at the Devil, the record, and it was in the gatefold. And I opened up that gatefold, and I'm like, holy shit. You know, these are like, you know, Mad Max, friggin', I don't even know why. You know, they're just from, like, these guys are from another world, you know, and there's fire and all this shit going on, and the Looks to Kill video and Smoking in the Boys Room, all that stuff just had a huge impression on me. And it really, to this day, it defines the genre. You know what I mean? It defines the genre. I think so many people were trying to be Motley Crue. People have even fessed up to it, that, you know, that if they tried to, they saw what Motley Crue was doing, and they did the same thing. And then the next couple years later, Crew comes out with Girls, Girls, Girls. Everybody imitates that image. So just a very important band, and a band that was just, they were interesting. Every time they did a new album, they had a different look. They had a different logo, right? Their logo changed. Their sound would change. There's just so much to unpack with Motley Crue, but, you know, it's just, and all four guys were important. You know, when you think people talk about Kiss or the Beatles, these guys all made this sound, and you knew them all. Vince was very distinct with his look and sound. Nikki was very outspoken, and then you had your really musical guys were Mick and Tommy, who were just powerhouse musicians. So just a magical hair metal pairing of guys, man.
Totally. Good. Yeah, and you speak of this, the importance and the impact of that lighter, glammier look, and you know, specifically what Motley did in 85. You got older and other bands like Quiet Riot and Twisted Sister, Ozzy, Wasp. Can you explain like this movement, and was it a wise career choice by those bands to lighten up their image?
You know, that's a good question. I really don't know, because I don't know of any of the ones that really tried hard to fit into that. I don't know if they were very successful at it. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was almost like you had to do it because you wouldn't look right. You know what I mean? And when you go back and not to, because I love Keel, and Keel's in the book, but if you look at Keel, I always felt like Keel was like one step behind. Like when you look at Motley Crue in 85, and then you look at Keel in 85, Keel kind of looks like Motley did in 84 or 83. You know what I mean? So it's like, like they were just behind. So like if you wanted to stay ahead and be fresh with like the buying public, you had to lighten it up. You had to play the game, because that's what the most popular band. I mean, look at the most popular bands pretty much at that point. You know, between Brat, Motley Crue, and then you got into 86, you got into Bon Jovi, David Lee Roth. I mean, these dudes were really flashy, and if you weren't sticking with that, you kind of were going to get lost in the dust. The only thing, like I said, some of them, it didn't work. You're not going to make Twisted Sister look like pretty boys. You know what I mean? It's just not going to work. I almost think they should have went a whole, even to a more of a darker extreme or something like that, because I think, you know, it's just trying to put a square where a circle should be kind of thing. It just didn't work. So for some of them, it worked. Some of them, it didn't. A lot of them regret it. You know, like Don Dokken said he regretted it, and he felt like Under Lock and Key kind of stuck with them. And, you know, that's just a cool other thing, is that the book was like a living document. It was basically done, and then all of a sudden, there's this string of interviews that happened. You know, Don Dokken, George Lynch, Ron Taylor, and I was able to insert them right into the living document right before I pulled the trigger. So it was so cool that, you know, especially Dokken. No offense to Ron Taylor, because I love Ron Taylor. I love Lillian X, but Dokken is a real big one. And to just have some insight from those guys about all this, and I won't lie, I skewed my questions for my own narrative. So you know what I mean? So, but we all got something out of it. They are promoting their album. I helped them do that. They helped me with some book information. So one hand washes the other.
Yep, perfect. You know, and this whole lighter image, it helped Dubrow have nice, big, beautiful hair. So that's one positive. All right, so the term hair metal, okay, it's an often controversial term. I really liked Stephen Piercy's thoughts on it.
Yeah.
Especially coming from the guy whose band was labeled fashion rock when they debuted. So what do you think of the term, and what do you think of how Piercy phrased it?
You know, I say it in the book. He seemed to be okay with it. So then in turn, I kind of wondered, why are you not okay with it? You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, you've got to put a stamp on this. And let's be real here. There's a certain kind of a look and sound when we talk about hair metal. You know, when we say it, we know we're talking about Poison, Cinderella, Motley Crue, Rat. We know that's what we're talking about. If we say 80s rock, we could be talking about Rick Springfield. If we talk about 80s metal, we could be talking about Metallica. We don't know what we're talking about until we say hair metal. So and Dee Snider made a point too. I never interviewed Dee Snider, so if you read the book, you realize that most of the stuff that's inserted in the book from the artists are the artists that I talked to, because I would have loved to have had a lot of stuff from more stuff in the book about Poison and Cinderella. But I looked at it this way: I never talked to either band, and I feel like they've probably been beat to death in other books. So I tried to focus on some of the more rare artists that probably don't get the spotlight as much as big bands like Cinderella and Poison. But Cinderella and Poison are both in there. And now I realize that I'm going all over the place like the people I interview do. So
No, dude, you're
so good. I had no problem with the hair model term. It started as a negative, but I think it's a good thing. I mean, if people are so against it, then call Sirius and tell them not to play your song on Hair Nation.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they'll sign up for that one.
Done. Mic drop. Okay.
That's right. All right, cool. So a revelation you detail in the book is record label control.
Yeah.
And to a naive teen in the late 80s, for an example, we were just supposed to believe that Mark Slaughter was supposed to be the guy in Vinnie Vincent, and that his audition tape simply didn't have a return address on the package.
Right.
So talk to me about the truths that you uncovered in speaking to these artists.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big one. You know, it's there, you know, because I think it's hard to find. It took me a while. I had to go back because I'm talking to Robert Fleischman, who sang on the Vinnie Vincent album. I'm talking to Goran Edman, who almost got in Vinnie Vincent. You know, later he got to play with Yngwie. So that story kept sticking into my mind. Like, oh, Mark Slaughter was supposed to do it, but we lost his tape, and so we had to get this other guy. That story is complete bullshit. You know, so the book debunks that story. But the other thing that you're seeing is, you know, label pressure. It goes through the whole book, and not to reveal who we point fingers in at the end of the book, but I think it wouldn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that labels are a big culprit in the building up of this and the destruction of it. You know what I mean?
And, yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of shit. And okay, this is everybody knows this. You know, think about the Cherry Pie story. You know, we all know the Cherry Pie guy story, and he wanted to shoot himself for writing Cherry Pie. You mean Cherry Pie was label pressure? You know what I mean? So labels had a big hand in this, but you've also got to put blame in other areas. You've got to put the blame on the bands too, because at the end of the day, Janie Lane could have said no, but he didn't. So there was he wanted to be on top. He wanted to stay on top. He wanted to be famous, you know. So I think fame, so there's these abstract concepts that are actually to blame. It's not just, you know, oh, we're going to blame grunge, okay? That's way too easy, man. There's like abstract concepts that you have to blame, like emotions and feelings and greed and things like that. So these are the things that destroy anything that's good. You know, you could put this in any trend that you could ever think of. You could go back and you could look at disco. You could look at what's going on with superhero movies today. It's mm-hmm. greed and putting a bunch of shit out that's just like something else that's come out. And when that happens, the public's going to lose interest. So, you know, we can sit all day and analyze the death of hair metal. You know, hair metal was born to die. You know what I mean? Anything that gets big, it doesn't stay big forever. You know what I mean? You look at somebody like Taylor Swift, and everybody's talking about how huge she is. And my wife and I always say, she's going to tank. They all tank at some point, and she will. It might not be for a while, but it will happen. So, you know, anything right. that's huge has to crash. And that's where we are with it today. It still exists, but it's really just a shell of what it was.
Well, you're a big Wasp guy, and it seemed like Wasp was maybe potentially your gateway drug into the harder stuff.
Yeah.
Would that be a pretty accurate statement?
Yeah. You know, there's a couple key albums that I go through in the book, and these were albums that I wanted to talk about because they stood out to me, and the major thing that stood out to me was the covers. You know what I mean? I'd see Wasp album covers, and I'd be like, whoa, I need this. There's a guy painted up as a leopard in a blue neon cage. I think I like this. I'm going to buy this. I've never heard it. I don't even care. Yeah, Wasp was probably the gateway to the heavier stuff. Even though when I got into Wasp, they weren't at their super heaviest or darkest or anything like that. But yeah, I think Wasp was a gateway. And then Manowar was another one where I was like, just bought it by looking at the cover. And they were quite a bit heavier than Wasp was. So yeah, I mean, those were probably the gateway ones. And Anthrax was a big one. You know, Anthrax was just normal enough where it's kind of felt like some of the hair metal stuff because of Joey Belladonna. But then once you really got it was really fast, really heavy. They swore a lot. You know, they wore shorts. they were different. You know what I mean? So very interesting guys. They're funny. They like to bust balls and stuff. So they didn't take themselves too serious, and they played great music. So yeah, I think those are a few key bands that were That's how I got hooked on the heavy stuff.
Yeah, and keeping with that heavier era, you got, you know, Dio, like you mentioned, Manowar and Anthrax.
Yep.
Celtic Frost, Sabotage.
Yeah.
How is it that these albums cozied right up next to Open Up and Say Ah and Slippery When Wet for you?
I know.
And how is that? I mean, they're polar opposites.
They are, but I don't know. Like, growing up in that time, the stuff didn't seem that different to me. I think today people, you know, because once again, the hair metal label is offensive to many. So, like, if you said Manowar was hair metal, you know, you know, somebody cut your head off with a warrior sword, you know what I mean? Or if you were, you know, if you say the Sabotage is hair metal, you might get some pushback. But I think back in the day, like, it kind of all felt the same because,
yeah,
let's face it, it was all getting played on Headbangers Ball. Headbangers Ball, this is a realization. And damn it, I wish I could have put this in the book. But Headbangers Ball is like the melting pot of all this shit. Because you would watch it and you'd see Bon Jovi and then you'd see Sabotage and then you'd see, well, you wouldn't see Manowar because they really wouldn't play Manowar, but, you know, Europe and all, and Dio. So it was all there. And yeah, I really do think Headbangers Ball would probably normalize it so like it could all be together. And let's face it, a lot of them were on the same labels and, there was a lot of similarities. It's just that, like, one band was a lot heavier and another band was lighter. You know what I mean? But I still, they played the same kind of, you know, everybody was playing BC Rich, everybody was playing Ibanez, and, you know, it was like they felt the same even though they were drastically different.
Yeah, and it's great because I feel like it's all mood dependent, you know, like I've talked about my equal love for both versions of Van Halen, you know, if I'm feeling like sipping a margarita and hanging out, I'll put on OU812, and if I feel like rocking out with the fellas, I'll put on Van Halen 2, you know, so it's like, it's mood dependent, and I love the genre for it.
You know, the crazy thing too is you got to look at it this way. I mean, there are some people, I'm not one of these people, but there are some people that, my wife is like this, she'll be like, I like MC Hammer, I like Winger, I like, TLC, I like Metallica, you know, I'm not like that, you know what I mean? But at least I can vary it up within the framework of metal. I'll listen to hair metal,
right. And
I'll listen to thrash metal, you know, I do kind of, you know, I'll listen to some classic rock too, but I feel like that's about as crazy as I get, as just the different spectrums of rock and metal.
Well, cool, now we're going to enter the Yngwie era. And it's all coming out. So, you know, in the Yngwie research and speaking to various members, and I've heard the Joe Lynn Turner story. The label's basically built a money-making band with Odyssey.
Yeah.
Now, just like the biographies that we read from, you know, the Piercies and the other artists out there, it really spells out the ugliness. And I'm glad we were innocent and naive when it came to that, when we were young and going through it. But is it safe to say that this is where your Yngwie love began, was from the Odyssey album?
You know, that was hard to figure out. I mean, I don't know. I think I had the ones before. I mentioned it. I think I had Marching Out and I had Trilogy. But I don't think they registered the way that Odyssey did. Yeah, so Odyssey was where the real obsession about Yngwie kind of took place. But, you know, the thing about Yngwie, and you talk about it in the book, you know, like, you're going to hear what Goran Edmond says about Yngwie. You're going to hear what Joe Lynn says about Yngwie. Yngwie's kind of a dick, you know what I mean? And Yngwie is a control freak, you know what I mean? I think he could have had the world. I think if he just would have just been a member of a band, and he could have had a lot of say in what went on in that band, but for him to just have to have his name on it and him on the cover, you know, you might have impressed the guitar nerds, but you weren't going to impress the girls, and you weren't going to impress the average music fan. You know what I mean? So I think he could have played the game a little bit more. God bless him that he did it. You know, he's an original, and he did life his own way, and he'll always be looked at as a legendary guitar player. It's funny, there's a story that's just out today where he says, it was on some website, Loudwire or something, and he's like, I don't need any singers, I don't need any producers, and I don't need any outside songwriters. And I actually tagged it, and I was like, no, you actually do. You actually do. You haven't made a good album in, like, I don't even know when. Maybe, like, 20 years or something. It's been a while. And I even thought the ones that he did with Tim Ripper Owens. And I love Tim Ripper Owens. I love his voice. But I don't think that was even right. I don't even think those songs were that great. So I think he he would benefit from having some outside influence. I mentioned in the book, the biggest tragedy in metal, in my opinion, is that Dio and Yngwie didn't make an album together. Or
yes, because exactly.
I think we've talked about this before on the podcast. It's this ego. You know what I mean? I got to be in a band called Dio. I got to be in a band called Yngwie's Rising Force. The egos never would have worked, but man, the lyrics and the vocals and the melodies of Dio with the guitar work and riffs of Yngwie, man. And we'll never see it because now Ronnie's passed, so it's a dirty shame.
Yep. All right. Well, I sense a theme as the book goes on, and has to do with Queen and TNT and Queensryche and Limited Axe and Sabotage. The cerebral kind of deeper thing kind of grabbed you.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I'm like a sex, cars, booze, chicks, simple AC/DC, Motley, girls type.
Yeah.
I still obviously like all the bands I just mentioned, but would it be accurate that as your years went on, you kind of gravitated towards these type of bands a little bit more?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that you framed that pretty good, because I think that's why it makes sense that I didn't buy a lot of up-and-coming hair bands like in 91 and 92. Yeah, I think that's where I was going, you know what I mean? I felt like I liked that deeper stuff. I didn't have a problem with any of the... I'm a Kiss fan. Come on, let's I'm a Kiss fan. That's all I'm going to say. So, I mean, X and sex and all this crap. Make me rock hard. I mean, I'm used to all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find the bands that maybe told stories or something that was uplifting. I also, Queen isn't necessarily, I don't think Queen Roy's the best lyricist, but I think what I liked about Queen was those multi-vocals, the harmonies, the melodic leads, and just super great melodies. You know what I mean? So that's why I mentioned Queen a couple times, because I think when bands implemented the Queen sound, like TNT did and Sabotage did, I really liked it, you know what I mean? Because I was a big Queen nut. And unfortunately, as I mentioned in the book, I didn't get into Queen heavily till the end, when, you know, the year that Freddie Mercury died, which really sucked. But so, you know, Queen pretty much ended at that point. Yeah, no, I did kind of grab it. You know, Warrior Soul is another example. That's a band that is not a hair band. They sing a lot of deep political stuff against things that were going on in society, and I did really like that. So I do like deeper concepts. Operation Mindcrime is one of my favorite albums. I think it's so cool. A lot of the Queensryche stuff is cool. And it was really awesome that I got to talk to Jeff Tate, because I feel like, I think I probably told you, like after I interviewed him, and this happens to me all the time. Sometimes I get that vibe where I'm like, oh, this guy was kind of a jerk. Like, he didn't like me or something, you know. But you got to take it like this is just how these people are. George Lynch was the same way. I was like, oh, I don't know, man. Lynch was a tough interview. I don't know if he was down with it. And then somebody messaged me. I think it was Paul Miles, who wrote all the Motley Crue books. And he's like, you know, I think George was really liking this interview. And that's unusual. So, you know, it's just sometimes the way it feels when you're doing it is like, oh, I don't know if that went over that great. Jeff Tate was really cool. He gave me a lot of cool information about Operation Mindcrime, the Empire Tour. And I threw that in the book. I threw in a little bit about George Lynch. So sometimes it was those interviews that felt awkward or whatever. They really weren't that bad. And maybe these people are just a little bit more difficult than the average person. And I bet you the bandmates would say the same thing. They just have a certain way. I mean, Don Dokken will tell you that. And I'm sure the guys at Queensryche. I mean, Jeff Tate is known that he can be a little bit difficult. But I probably got one of the, you know, better versions of him as a human being talking to me. So, you know, it's weird. I think for the most part, everybody was very cool that I ever talked to. But like I said, you get those ones where they probably didn't really want to deal with it, but some manager or some publicist is making them do it. Sometimes you got some of that, but I think overall everybody was pretty cool.
And selfishly, that's where my podcast introduction began, because I came on for the last few minutes after Jeff Tate was finished up.
You did. That's right. I know. I should go back and listen to that. That's where our podcasting gig together started. So, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. All right. So, Cinderella, Winger, Bullet Boys. What a lineup from that concert you were at. So, you know, I know you're a young man, and people often ask me, I go to a concert and they say, oh, did they play this song? Did they play that song? And I go, man, I don't know. I can't remember. So we know Winger was amazing live.
Yep.
Bullet Boys seemed to be energetic and cool.
Yep.
But was Cinderella as good as people say they are live?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And I mentioned that in the book. It's like it sounded just like the record. And I remember even being a kid thinking, kind of surprised, because I saw Motley Crue a couple years earlier. And even as a 11-year-old kid, I knew Vince's voice just wasn't the same as it was. It wasn't horrible, but it wasn't the same as what you hear on the record. It definitely sounded different. Right. You can tell Vince has some studio work done on him, and maybe he doubles it or whatever it is that he does. It sounds different. He's not shit-faced, maybe. I don't know. The studio versus the record, or versus the live show. But Cinderella was spot on, and it was cool because when you listen to what everybody says, you know, that was on that tour, how great he was. And I'm saying he was great. Right, you know, I'm with you. Could I tell you what every song they played? No. But were there key moments that I remember? Of course. And I'll never forget Night Songs, because Night Songs was just so cool and heavy. And the whole stage was purple and smoky, and it was almost like they were trying to recreate the Night Songs album cover, even though they weren't as glammed out at that point. But you know, it was just like it was wicked cool, man. And those are those, and that's what I did. Even I don't even know if some of the stuff I recount in the book at the concerts is even accurate. But I look at it like it's how I remember it. You know what I mean? So maybe some of this shit didn't even happen, but it happened in my mind, and that's where this whole book comes from. There's probably shit that is not accurate. I'm sure most books you get from people like Kiss and all these guys, there's no way these people remember all this shit. Even Nikki Sixx is being called out by Tom Werman, right? There's no way to remember like exact conversations you had with people 30 years ago. But, you know, it's just how it is in your brain. So that's what I tried to put out there. What I remembered, that T-shirt was really important to me, so I mentioned it. You know what I mean? These are just the random things that I remember. Other people might remember totally different things. So it's just what's left in this noggin of mine. So
yeah, you know, I saw Cinderella and Poison and Quiet Riot with Dubrow and Firehouse when they did a package tour in like the early 2000s, and it was at a Great America, which is a big theme park in Santa Clara, California, and they opened with Night Songs, and I thought, damn, that's such an odd opener, because I think it is as a slower song, so but heavy. Then watching it, I thought, oh, this makes perfect sense. It's hard as shit, and it's a slow chugger. This is killer.
Yep.
So I specifically remember that song as an opener, but pretty much nothing else. And also, I met Jeff LaBar there, because he was walking around the theme park with his wife or girlfriend at the time and took like pictures with people and autographs. He's really sweet. So that was a cool memory.
Yeah, that's the closest we get to a Cinderella member in the book is Jeff LaBar's brother. There's some comments from him. And I've mentioned this a million times on the podcast. I was this close to having Tom Kiefer on the show, and it was for this tour that was going to be with Stephen Piercy and Skid Row and all these guys, and it got canceled right before COVID, or right before COVID, it got canceled. And then it was like interviews stopped, and they didn't want to talk about anything, and then that was it. I lost my Tom Kiefer. But I did talk to him for like 2 seconds in the grocery store. I was in the grocery store. He called me because the publicist screwed up the dates, and he called me on the wrong day or some shit. So, you know, it always burns my ass that I was like, I almost had Tom Kiefer. Because he doesn't do a lot of interviews, and that would have been prime shit to have in the book. But it is what it is.
Ah, damn it.
Yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, Crew 89. Motley 89 was just universally humongous. Yeah. It was just their peak of their peak professionally, but do you believe it was their peak musically?
No, it wasn't their peak musically. And you know, one thing that I think happens to everybody is especially when you have a band that you really like, that brand new album is their best, right? for like maybe a couple years, maybe it's their best.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you start to realize like, it starts to wear off. You know what I mean? Like, you know, Dr. Feelgood is nowhere as good as Shout at the Devil or Theater of Pain in my book, or Too Fast for Love. But I think what it is, right, it was the height of their career. And it was really a cool time to be a fan, because I think I even mentioned like the videos, you know, Motley Crue did like 5 videos, and that was unheard of. Motley Crue usually did 2 videos, you know what I mean? So like,
yeah,
you know, they were right up on par with like Bon Jovi and Def Leppard and all that kind of stuff. And it sold a shitload of copies, and they looked cool, and there was all kinds of cool posters and t-shirts that you could buy. So it was just a cool time to be a Motley Crue fan. And I do, I remember that walk after school. It was the first day of school of 1989. Got that puppy, went home, cranked it, and it was just, there was my boys. You know what I mean? It had been a couple years since we'd heard what they were up to, and they were sounding good, at least sound quality-wise, really good with Bob Rock. And the singles are all super good. It's just, I think, that, you know, at the end of the day, there's probably a couple throwaways on there. But overall, just a cool era of Motley Crue.
Very good. So earlier you mentioned that there was a theme, and it was timing, and it was
yeah.
singles being released and whatnot. So I'd like to talk about Boys in Heat real quick. It seems to be your underdog favorite. From the Britney catalog. But in listening to the interviews, it seems like there are some big mistakes regarding this album in terms of what singles were released, the cover art they don't like, the album title they don't like. Mike, can you kind of explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's just say if you're a Britney Fox fan, you're going to dig this book, because I think they probably get the most page time out of any band in this book, which is really odd. But I think it's because I've become probably a bigger Britney Fox fan today than I was even when I was a kid. And I talked to all of them. I talked to every single person except for Dean Davidson. So, of course, I've got a lot of information to share. And, Boys in Heat is that weird underdog album because, you know, I think the biggest problem is that Dean left the band during its run. You know what I mean? That's the biggest thing. But, I mean, the cover's goofy. Nobody likes the cover. You know, they didn't get picked up on certain tours that they probably could have. Just a lot of missteps in their eyes. But to me, I don't believe there's any missteps. I think I go back and listen to it, and I think it's a great album. You know, like I said, I think I would have released some different songs if I was the guy in control. But I think at the end of the day, you know, it's a really good album. I love listening to it to this day. It's my favorite Britney Fox album. But yeah, you know, there's some things that just probably didn't do them any favors. You know, if you think back, I mean, you could say like, wow, that look they had in 88 was a little, you know, too crazy, you know, with this Revolutionary War era glam or whatever, you know, with the puffy shirt, pirate metal, whatever you want to call it. But at least that got your attention. Those ugly, like, Cabbage Patch Kid looking guys that are on the Boys in Heat, you know what I mean? That's not going to make you want to buy. I mentioned I bought Britney Fox's album without ever hearing them based on the cover of the debut. You wouldn't have bought Boys in Heat based on the cover. You just have to buy it because you like Britney Fox.
Well, cool. All right. So 89 Whitesnake. Oof. It's a much different band that they created the 1987 album. But again, we love it.
Yep.
We share the love for that one.
Yep.
What appeals to you about 89 Slip of the Tongue so much with, is it Steve Vai or what do you think it is?
I don't know. I think it's a lot of different things. I think one of the key things was, I think the 1987 album was so huge, and I think it was easy to get burnt out on a lot of those songs because it just was overplayed, you know what I mean? So Slip of the Tongue was not overplayed, you know what I mean? They had a little bit of success, but nothing like they had for the 87 album. So I think it's the obscurity of it, you know, is appealing.
Mm-hmm.
I do like Steve Vai. As I mentioned in the book, I was big into Eat 'Em and Smile. So I think when Steve Vai is playing with somebody like David Lee Roth or David Coverdale, he really shines. So I think he shines on that album. And it's a little bit heavier. And I like heavier stuff. So, yeah, those are the kind of things that appeal to me about that one. It's the heaviness, the Steve Vai, and the obscurity of it.
Okay. Well, as we go down the line, a lot of killer 80s bands split. But, for instance, Widowmaker was born of Twisted Sister split.
Yep.
Arcade out of Rat.
Yep.
Lynch Mob and Don Dawkins' self-titled solo. Do you think we actually benefited from bands breaking up as fans?
What do you think? All right, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I can't think of a ton of bands that split that both had great output. I really just can't think. You got me, man. You really got me. Good job.
But it's your book's fault, man. This is your fault. But I read that shit and I was like, whoa.
Here's a couple.
Epiphany here.
Here's a couple. So I'll use Kiss as an example. So Kiss is actually a great example. I'm getting there.
Perfect.
I'm onto something.
Yeah,
okay, here we go.
I see what you're about to do here.
Okay, here we go. Okay, so you can look at it this way. You know, with Ace Frehley leaving Kiss, we got Frehley's Comet, which was some great stuff. At the same time, we had Kiss and Frehley's Comet out, so it's like double your pleasure, double your fun here, right?
Yeah.
Same thing happened with Vinnie Vincent. We got Vinnie Vincent Invasion. Yeah. We had Kiss albums out at the same time. But what I'm going to say about at least both of those is that I really do think that, like, Vinnie Vincent in Kiss is better than him outside of Kiss. Ace Frehley, the same thing. So I really would have liked to see those guys stay and see what we could have gotten. And it's the same thing when it comes to there was another one that came to mind. Oh, Dokken and Lynch, you know. It's so cool that we got Lynch Mob, and it was great that we got the Don Dokken album. But I would like to see what would have been if we had that, you know, Don Dokken or actually, both of their mindsets at that time doing an album together. So I think it's cool. I mean, if it's inevitable and it's going to happen and we get another, you know, couple albums out of it as separate entities, that's cool. But I think that at the end of the day, I would have preferred a lot of these people to stay with the bands and see what would have been next. So.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Well, we move on to Stryper. So I'm just going to kick it off. Against the Law. It's my favorite Stryper album. But, and it's their least favorite. What's so bad about it, in Michael Sweet's opinion?
You know, he talks about it, and I put it in the book. You know, basically, he just feels that it's not a true Stryper album. And I get it. Most bands who do a departure album, you got to look at it this way, Ryan. If it's a departure album and it doesn't sell well, you know, it's basically blacklisted. You know, in their catalog,
yeah.
They won't play songs from it. They don't really acknowledge it. Kiss has done that. I'm sure AC/DC doesn't dig too deep on Fly in the Wall, or you know what I mean? It's like everybody's got those kind of like dud albums or departure albums that they just don't really acknowledge. So I get what he's saying. You know, you got to look at it this way. As a fan, you can sit and listen to that album all day. And I listen to it a lot. I love it. But I get where he's coming from. If you do look at where they were, you know, they're a Christian band. They wear yellow and black. You know, this is what they do. Should they be allowed to step outside of that framework and do something? Of course. But, like, it's the same thing like Kiss. You know, when Kiss did music from The Elder, it was a concept album. They cut their hair, played a different kind of music. Everybody hated it. So your fans dictate what it is that you can do. Now, if you look, if we talk about these a couple of these Stryper albums in the book. If you look at To Hell with the Devil, In God We Trust, and Against the Law, it's a downward spiral of sales. It's platinum, gold, nothing. You know what I mean? So you got to look at it this way. So at the end of the day, they're reacting to what the fans want. So overall, fans, you know, because what happened? I'll tell you exactly what happened because I was there and I bought the damn thing. The people that like traditional Stryper were not impressed. They were like, man, what happened to my band? You know, this is ridiculous. Now they're trying to be like a Motley Crue or something like that. The people that like Motley Crue, oh, Stryper's wannabe of the, you know, they're trying to be tough guys. I don't buy it, you know. So nobody bought it on either side of the fence. So that's why he doesn't care for this album. It's not Stryper. And I get where he's coming from, but look at man, we're all freaks, fans of music, right? We're all fanatics, and we're all freaks, and we're always going to gravitate to some weird album for whatever reason, and it's okay. You know, if we like Against the Law, that's fine. I get why they don't like it, and I get why they don't play it, but hey, they can't stop us from listening to it, right? Maybe you can.
Exactly.
You can pull it from Spotify like a lot of other people pull shit off Spotify.
Yeah, if you like it so much, pull it off. I get it.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, this is more of a comment straight out of jealousy, but Stryper, Queensryche, Rat, you purchased their brand new albums in one day as a young man.
Yep.
That must have been a killer feeling, man.
Yeah.
So I just got to comment on that one. That's freaking awesome.
Yeah.
That's a big day for a music guy.
Well, you got me thinking about something I want to touch on. A lot of people will dispute when. I don't think anyone disputes Against the Law and Detonator. Those, for sure, were released the same day. There's high disputes about when Empire was released, okay? So I don't even know what dates are, but it never falls into when I think it came out. And you can't trust Wikipedia because who the hell put that there? I don't know. It could have been anybody. You know what I mean? So in my mind, Ryan, the way that I remember it, because and here's how I remember it. All three of them came in cardboard boxes, the CDs. This is when they were in cardboard boxes. Okay. I even mentioned this in the book. I had to have all my walls covered, okay? And the most pain in the ass spot to cover up is right above your window, right? From the ceiling to your window. It's like a little weird rectangle. Okay, how are you gonna cover that? Well, guess what you're gonna do? Yeah. You're gonna chop up the box and you're gonna put the pictures all in there. So I remember doing that with all three of those. So I remember having them all at the same time. And another thing that I remember is that I remember gravitating instantly to Empire, and then I remember the other two took a little bit longer to get into. And what the point I'm trying to make is that, like, when you bought this thing and you paid $17 for it, you needed to get to know it, right? You needed to spend some time with it. And when you're getting three at once, somebody's going to just, you know, blow somebody else out of the water. You know what I mean? You're gonna gravitate toward one, and you're like, wow, that Queensryche. And let's face it, Empire, upon first listen, is pretty damn great. You know what I mean? So I think Empire, you know, was way more interesting, way more creative than those other two albums. I got into those other two. It just took a little bit longer because somebody had to go to the forefront. So that's the way I remember it. You know, you got to look at it this way. Albums came out differently in Europe. They came out differently even in Canada. So I'm sticking to that album came out on August 20th. I think that's the date that I mentioned in the book. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay.
All three of those bad boys came out the same day, and everything contradicts that. I think now that I think about it, everything says September 5th. I'm saying August 20th. I'm sticking to my guns.
All right. Well, we're wrapping it up here on this, but I want to say you have a really, really cool take on the whole grunge takeover. I think that people should read it. If you'd like to touch upon it in the Reader's Digest version of it, you're welcome to right now. But I'd never thought of this, and I think you have a really good take on what happened at the end there.
Right.
So it's up to you. If you want to tease it out there and say, buy the book, assholes. Buy the book and read it for yourself, or feel free to tease it a little bit.
Buy the book, assholes.
Yeah, boy.
No, I mean... It's all I'm going to say, and I said this in the beginning, and I'll say now. Going into it, I didn't think it was going to have a point. I'm dead serious. All I thought I was going to do was just going to go through each year that I went through, and I was going to tell you what albums I bought, insert the bands that I talked to, tell you about the concerts I went to, touch on the fandom stuff like the the T-shirts and the posters and the record store. That's all that I thought that this was going to be. Almost like a diary or me just reflecting on each year. But what happened is that I kept hearing the same kinds of stories, right? And I started, and when you put everybody's things that they talked about in a silo, right? Like I was put everything they talked about in 86, everything 87, everything, you know, all the way to 91, you're going to see similar themes. You know what I mean? So a lot of the people, here's what I will say, in the bands themselves, did not believe that grunge killed the genre. So, you know, and then with their thoughts on it and with what I kind of pieced together, I didn't really believe it either. So that's what I'll say about it. And I think the book ends pretty strong. You know what I mean? I do like the way the book ends. I'll give myself that. You know, I'm a very critical person. I'm very critical of myself. But I do like the way the book ends. I think I point fingers at a lot of different people, a lot of different concepts. It's not cut and dry. It's not that easy. That's the main thing. It's way too easy to say that grunge killed hair metal. That's too easy.
Oh, yeah.
And I think if you have even one, you know, intellectual bone in your body, you know, and after you read all this, you're going to realize that if that was a suspect, they're like the least of the suspects. And that's the best way to put it.
Okay. One thing I'll say is I thought it was super killer that Don Dawkins stuck up for Kip Winger and that Metallica reference in the interview with him.
And that just came out of nowhere. See, that's the beauty of like conversation. even with us just having a conversation today, hopefully people don't take this as just some infomercial for the book. We had a nice discussion about hair metal, you know, and I don't ever know what these guys are going to say. That's, you know, and I'm hoping, like I said, I want to do another installment of the book. I'd like to get deeper into, like, the whole podcast piece, because I really I put a little bit about it, but not much, because if we didn't have the podcast, we wouldn't have the interviews. That's basically all that I can say about it, but I really wanted to keep it, and, you know, maybe the book could have been longer, but I felt like it had to begin in 86 when I got into this music, and it had to end in 91. I don't know. That was just all that was in my head. Like, it has to end, you know, and we can do another installment where we'll pick up the pieces. It'll be like after a nuclear war, right? The bands are going to step out into this new world that, you know, the world's changed, you know what I mean? I want to start the next one just like that, you know, so I hope people buy it. Hope we can do another one. Look, this is my last pitch for the book. I've never peddled T-shirts. I've never peddled hats, okay? I'm not mocking anybody who does it, but all they do is take in the image that they use for their podcast, plop it on a shirt, it takes them 5 minutes, and they probably sell it to you for $30, okay? All I'm giving you is the 80s glam metal hat cast greatest hits, right? It's every little bit of different thing that person I ever talked to, and it's not just the run-of-the-mill shit. It's rare bands. There's probably bands in there that you love, but, like, nobody that you know on the planet knows who they are. That's the way, at least the way it feels. This is what's in there. This is who I am. If you ever even wonder, like, well, what is this guy's story? I'm not saying I'm anybody that you would care to know what my story is, but, you know, I put my story out there. Maybe it's similar to your story. Maybe you can relive some of this shit through me. Maybe you're a young kid who missed all of this. Well, I'm telling you from the aspect of another young kid who went through it, what it was like. You know what I mean? We grew up in a magical period. You know, in the 90s, I thought I was a loser. I didn't think I was a loser, but they made you think like you were a loser because you saw Motley Crue live. Now I know I'm a legend because I saw Motley Crue live and I saw Cinderella live. I know I'm honored that I saw that Cinderella Winger Bullet Boys concert. So this is just me going through the fandom. Here's another thing. Well, man, this is – I'm telling you, I'm on a roll now. Watch out, people. Somebody asked me in a message board, you know, there's this other book. And I thought that was pretty, you know, the pretty complete story of hair metal. How does yours compare? A, I didn't read the book that he talked about. I have no idea how it compared. I have read other hair metal books, but I have not read the one that he mentioned. There's no way that it can compare. Okay, I am the one who asked the questions to the bands. I'm the one who had the thoughts of things that I wanted to know, and they told them to me directly. Have they told these stories before? Of course. But this is me asking the bands that I grew up on. Nobody's going to have the same exact story as me. It's impossible. I'm me. You know what I mean? Like, I know some of it's going to be similar. So this is not the most definitive. I'm not going year by year and telling you every single album that came out. I'm not doing that. I'm just telling you a story about how this stuff got big and how it died. And I'm putting in little bits about things that I did during that. So all it is, it's a hair metal journey. It's not the definitive thing where, like, it's not an encyclopedia, right? It's just a story that's trying to give you a vibe and a feeling. That's all that it is. And with that, I got nothing. I'm out.
Well, shit. That's a perfect way to end this thing. That was great. I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you, man. You interviewed me and came up with questions. You took your time. I appreciate it. You're always taking your time coming on the podcast and everything. So I appreciate you. I appreciate everybody that bought the book. I just wanted people to connect with it. I just hope that people enjoy it. And, you know, I would love to do another one. I would love to do 92 to whatever. So we'll see. I don't know.
That'd be great.
I'm not sure what we're
at. Yeah, it's always a highlight, you know, coming on the show and speaking to you and now reading the book. So job well done. It's really cool.
Thanks, brother.
Well, I don't know, man. I think Ryan did a pretty good job. Maybe he needs his own podcast. Maybe he doesn't need Metal Mike. Who knows? But what you need to do is buy A Hair Metal Journey on Amazon. And now it's time to rock on.